Welcome to History and D&D. In the last episode, we discussed the 2000s and the publishing of 3rd edition, as well as a contest held by Wizards of the Coast, which helped find the new campaign setting of Eberron. We also discussed the ever-increasing attendance at Gen Con and how public perception had changed from negative to slightly positive in mainstream culture over the years. Meanwhile, the 3rd edition of the game had helped grow the hobby, especially due to its open gaming license. The 2010s started off with a bang. The world was recovering from the economic meltdown of 2008. The meltdown's immediate cause was subprime mortgages, as I'm sure you've heard before. These were mortgages given to individuals who on paper could barely afford the payments, and in reality, really couldn't. Why am I getting into this? Well, because the attitude that underlies these results is very similar to things I mentioned about the business side of this hobby. These mortgages were packaged as bundled debt, which were purchased by various financial entities as investments. The idea, buy poor debt for cheap as a risk, but be rewarded greatly if enough of the debt was repaid. This kind of thing exemplifies the enthusiasm and over-optimistic outlook society can have. Many of the individuals involved, including those supplied in and those who received the mortgages, knew that they really couldn't afford them. They were just hoping for and expecting better times. As most of you know, this didn't pan out. The rotten debt vehicle slowly infected financial markets, and then bam, financial crisis. Due to quick intervention by central banks and the government, the economy was saved by a liquid injection. And it took several months or years for various regions around the world to recover. And recover we did. I see this as similar to the overproduction and exuberance of TSR in both the 80s and 90s, as well as their overuse of debt tools. Remember that TSR in its early days made extravagant purchases under Gygax and the Blooms that overstretched the company's resources. Add to that, under Lorraine Williams' leadership, the company overproduced product, shipped it to Random House to then be paid by Random House before the product had even been sold. As discussed in the last episode, TSR incurred debt to their printer as Random House began to return product. This resulted in the printer refusing to print, and Random House sued to get their money back. TSR had almost no way to pay its debt and nearly collapsed before Wizards of the Coast bought it. You see, their expectations of better times ahead, coupled with risky expansionary plans, and the whole thing was just a little mirror of 2008 on a micro level, on the base of over-expectation alone. I'm planning to have many episodes where I connect various subjects, explain, and semi-equate them. Where was I at this point? Well, as a reaction to 9/11, security was a guaranteed job. So from about 2010 to 2015, I worked in various security positions. I started as a bouncer at nightclubs, then in movie pre-screening. As I moved into corporate and industrial security, I worked at an aircraft manufacturer and a vaccine maker. I ended off my security career at a cushy, low-paying job at a condo building as I prepared to train as a truck driver. Trucking was another guaranteed job and well-paying. And that's what I've been doing ever since. Now let's look at the two big contributors to the explosive growth of the role-playing hobby, podcasts and internet video. Podcast, a portmanteau of iPod and broadcast, was a term coined in 2004. Up until that point, it was referred to as audio blogging. Carl Malamud started his internet talk radio in 1993, which was an early form of this medium. The late 90s and early 2000s saw the emergence of several technologies that would allow audio bloggers to create, record, host, and eventually attach their audio to RSS feeds. The technology and software was there, but the convergence didn't happen until 2000 with RSS 0.92, after Tristan Lewis wrote a draft proposal and Dave Weiner updated the architecture of the RSS format. In 2003, an RSS to iPod script was created. In 2004, audioblog.com was launched by Eric Rice and Randy Dryberg. it was the first commercial podcast hosting service. As users grew, so did the interest, and more developer groups moved into the space. Meanwhile, detailed how to podcast articles appeared online. The user base kept growing, and eventually podcasting became widespread as mainstream media began reporting on the new phenomena and themselves began to offer some of their shows in podcast form. When Apple added podcasting to its iTunes software in 2005, the format exploded. Oxford Dictionary named podcast the word of the year. Now let's delve into the beginning of internet video. In 2000, a comedy trio called The Lonely Island, formed by Akiva Schaffer, Andy Samberg, and Jorma Taccone, created a website for their short sketches. Using iFilm, Heavy.com, and later Google Video and YouTube as hosting services, they created a large catalog of hilarious videos. I found their site in 2004 and laughed endlessly at their early series, The Boo, which was a parody of the hit TV show of the time, The O.C. Boo referred to Malibu, and O.C. referred to Orange County. That year, YouTube was founded by Steve Chen, Chad Hurley, and Javed Karim, who were all early employees of PayPal. It began as a venture capital-funded technology startup, primarily from an $11.5 million investment by Sequoia Capital and an $8 million investment from Artist Capital Management between November 2005 and April 2006. The first YouTube video, titled Me at the Zoo, shows co-founder Javed Karim at the San Diego Zoo. In 2005, SNL hired the Lonely Island Trio to create short comedy sketches. Their rap parody, Lazy Sunday, became a viral sensation. At the time of YouTube's official launch, it didn't have much of a market recognition. In the same week as that launch, Lazy Sunday was released. So unofficial uploads of the skit to YouTube drew in more than 5 million collective views by February 2006, before they were removed at the request of NBC Universal about 2 months later. YouTube was purchased by Google for $1.65 billion in 2006, after that company's own video sharing service failed to reach the mainstream success of YouTube. In 2007, they launched their partner program that shared advertising revenue with video creators. In January 2012, the site had 800 million unique users a month, and according to third-party web analytics providers Alexa and SimilarWeb, YouTube was the second most visited website in the world as of December 2016. So, by the end of the 2000s, both podcasting and YouTube had been firmly established in the mainstream. That meant anyone using these platforms to broadcast had many opportunities to find their audience. I'd say that many gamers, and that includes paper and pen role-playing gamers, are often more open to new technologies than many other groups. This is especially true on the back end of technology. And with these new avenues to explore, and a way to monetize it, many capitalized on these new technologies. So who were these players, and what were they doing on these public platforms? Here are several examples of some of the oldest D&D podcasts and when they began. In 2004, RPG MP3. In 2008, Acquisitions Incorporated and Critical Hit. 2009, Roll for Initiative. 2010, Save or Die. 2011, Geekspective. 2012, Greetings Adventures, Dragon Talk, the official D&D podcast, and Harmontown. Dan Harmon, creator of Community, and Rick and Morty created that podcast. In 2013, D&D UI, which stands for Dungeons & Dragons DUI. 2014, The Adventure Zone, Bored with Life, Total Party Kill, Party Roll, Dungeon Masters Block, and Pretend Wizards. In 2015, the famous Critical Role, D&D is for Nerds, Sneak Attack, Dragon Friends, Dungeon Master's Journey, Dungeon Drunks, That D&D Podcast, and God's Fall. Many of the D&D podcasts also have a home on YouTube, and many YouTubers also have podcasts. Here are some of the popular YouTube channels not mentioned above. Dungeons & Dragons, the official YouTube. D&D Beyond, How to Be a Great Game Master, Matt Colville, Nerdarchy, WASD20, WebDM, XP to level 3, Puffin Forest, Dingo Doodles, Z Bashu, Taking 20, High Rollers, Mark Holmes, Wormwood, Runehammer, and Dungeoncraft. Now there's many more. YouTube channels have varying topics and themes, and they can be about how to play or improve the game, campaign discussions, news updates, live plays, but the topics are way more varied than that. Not to mention all the D&D adjacent channels. There's no end to RPG hobby channels. Many podcasts are hours-long recordings of game sessions, while some are different discussions about various ideas and aspects surrounding the hobby. YouTubers often focus on discussing topics ranging from the rules to news about the hobby and deep dives in how to improve your game. If you think about the plethora of blogs, forums, and other websites that deal with D&D, as well as all the adjacent ones that talk about tabletop gaming and RPGs, there's an endless supply of information and entertainment surrounding the game itself. Right around the time that a website devoted to all things nerdy, named Geek & Sundry, started in 2012, it seemed like every celebrity came out of the woodwork to declare their love of D&D. The most notable was Vin Diesel, but others included Rivers Cuomo, Felicia Day, Judi Dench, James Franco, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Matt Groening, Dan Harmon, Dwayne Johnson, Matthew Lillard, Joe Magnaola, Stephen Colbert, Anderson Cooper, Moby, Mike Myers, Robin Williams, Jon Favreau, Marilyn Manson, George R.R. Martin, Elon Musk, Patton Oswalt, Trey Parker, John C. Reilly, Kevin Smith, Steven Spielberg, Carl Urban, Will Wheaton, Josh Whedon, Rainn Wilson, Deborah Ann Woll, and Andrew Yang, to name a few. I mean, I guess that was a few. That was a list, and a few people were on it. As stated in previous episodes, the player base and convention attendance grew over time, but in this period, they both exploded. It was into a rapidly changing world that Wizards of the Coast launched two separate editions of the game 7 years apart. First came 4th edition, which was launched in 2007-08. To some, it seemed as if it was dropped from above into the hobby. Many felt that it was too closely designed to be an adaptation of video games, specifically the massively multiplayer online game World of Warcraft. It was mostly rejected by fans, although there are many who enjoy that edition, especially those of whom that was their first experience with D&D. How true the criticisms are, I can't say. Not only did I not play it, until 2014, I was unaware of its existence, and to this day, I haven't read it. But one day, I might try it out. In 2012, Wizards of the Coast announced that they were working on 5th edition. It was released initially as a public open playtest in direct contrast to the secretive nature of previous editions. The first playtest packet was released in 2013. In 2014, they released a free PDF containing the basic rules called the SRD, System Reference Document. And similar to the open license of 3rd edition, everything contained in the SRD was free of copyright. This made 5th edition partially open and partially closed. Wizards and Hasbro could control the lucrative IPs, like the Beholder, Mind Flayers, and various settings and stories in the game, but fans of the game and outside companies could create content that would be compatible. By 2014, I was all in on the new edition. I had watched every YouTube video and read every article I could to learn about the new edition. I immediately bought the core books when they came out, and in later months, I bought copies of the Player's Handbook for several of my friends. Since the 70s, the makers of D&D, as well as their customers, have debated how much content they need. From a corporate perspective, the debate was monetary in nature, meaning that they could determine what customers wanted by what was sold. But this is a very limited and most basic form of market research. From the customer standpoint, it was difficult to know if your voice was being heard. While one could contact the company by various methods, and this contact varied between welcomed or not, it was unclear if any meaningful changes were made at the managerial or development level. Not much indicates that they were until Wizards of the Coast took over. At a rudimentary level, the new owner of D&D slowly instituted changes in how they interacted with their customers. Of course, technology improved and created contact channels and streamlined how metrics could be acted upon. One of the biggest changes was the amount of products that were produced as each edition progressed. The first edition had a number of products and a fairly large line of them, but second and later third edition became a glut from the perspective of most customers. Many of these customers became increasingly irate that there were so many things to buy. I never fully understood this, as I still contend that you don't have to buy any of it. But I know that many in the hobby choose to feel that they are compelled to purchase, and they therefore become upset that they have to spend lots of money on everything. By fourth edition, this trend of ever-increasing product lines started to reverse. At the time of this podcast, we're sitting outside of 5 years of fifth edition, and now most customers decry that there's not enough product. So Wizards still needs to find the right balance, although I'd suggest that many people have no idea what the hell they want. But whatever it is they do want, by God, they're mad as hell that it's certainly not what they're getting. In addition to all the technology that has made this renaissance of D&D possible, there are many more digital as well as analog tools available to help or improve the game. The three most significant of which are Twitch, Roll20, and Fantasy Grounds. The latter two allow players and their DM to gather remotely to play. It offers many functions to streamline the feel of online play. Individuals can use video and voice communication, and also background music playlists. In addition, there's a lot of software tools to automate the actions and calculations a player would normally write on paper or do in their head. In the middle of all this is the ease at which maps, grids, and tokens can be used, and it's never been easier to start up a game. Once a group has all that mastered, if they want to, they can broadcast it online using Twitch, which can also help the group monetize their game. There are also other ways to monetize an individual's public hobby persona. From the YouTube partner system discussed earlier, Patreon, Amazon affiliate links, Kickstarter, DM's Guild, DriveThruRPG, and many more. In the next episode, I'll take a look at the overall culture and RPG culture in the last 50 years, and how it morphed into what we're in now. This has been History and D&D. Hadad! I hope your day is free of thunderbolts.